Thank you very much to Jacob for this, what I believe was a very concise and fruitful juxtaposition of the positions by Belting and Summers. And I'm sure they have provoked, I think, actually the sound is not really good. It's squeaking, if that's okay for the auditing. Okay. I'm sure that has provoked a number of questions. James Elkins. Sorry.
I have a kind of devil's advocate question just to start out. I wonder if you could spend a few minutes doing some critical work on the slash, Summers slash Belting. Can we put some distance between them? And it occurs to me one way to do that might be to invoke this. I know that this conference is about younger voices, not older ones, but there's an even older voice here, Heidegger, who might be invoked to try to make this separation a little wider. And what I would have in mind there would be an argument, actually, that I've had with David Summers. He doesn't think he's beholden to Heidegger. He's repressed it, in my opinion. And he thinks George Kubler is the guiding star of his enterprise. But with Hans Belting, it would be more complex. And I don't mean that your answer should necessarily turn on Heidegger, but I would like to know how you would articulate this distance between them.
Yeah, I did actually... Thank you for the question. I'm no expert on Heidegger, but I did mention him, so I kind of bear the responsibility here. But I did mention him to actually try to draw the two together. I would agree with you that in real spaces there definitely are Heideggerian overtones. And he even discusses him there, so I'm surprised that he now denies it or has been denied. I'm not really sure. I mean, I'm not really sure whether Heidegger would be someone I would use to actually separate the two. Belting, to my knowledge, Belting doesn't really engage Heidegger, at least not in this context. Unlike Summers in Real Spaces. So, but my idea of bringing him up was, I think that there's this general ethos in both accounts where we have somehow lost the sensitivity to the substitutive power of images, which it seems to me reminds me of some of Heidegger's discussions about, you know, the thing and the art and all that. So, and that the using image as just reference or as a commemoration is precisely runs parallel to Heidegger's, you know, history of metaphysics, of how we have moved to representations of the world away from, you know, the essence, the unveiling of truth. So that's all I can say right now. I'm sorry.
Ralf Ugel, who is next?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I found your reconstruction of Belting and Summers very convincing. And I just have a question, or maybe my suggestion, why your diagram?
Should have said more about that.
Is a better way to put the relationship between substitution and commemoration than the way Belting and Summers suggested to put this relationship. Now, my suggestion would be that I think both in Belting and in Summers they think that you can decide from the way a picture looks like, that the way a picture looks like says something about how it is used as a sign. This seems to be a flawed idea, because how a picture is used as a sign can only be understood by starting the practice of using it. And this is an argument that has been put forward by Lambert Wiesing and is implicit in Husserl, and has been put forward by other people. And I think what you have spelled out or implicitly in this diagram is that they, both of them, both in the, I think, particularly in Summer's brilliant books, they somehow committed this shortcut, this not conclusive argument that you can understand how a picture is used as a sign by just looking at it and deciding whether it's mimetic or not mimetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. I think there are moments in real spaces where Summers indeed can be read as saying, well, there's two categories of images. One of them are effigy-like, one of them are icon-like, and it almost seems like you just have to look at them to see whether they are icons or effigies, and that must be wrong for the reasons you mentioned. But on his best day, he is careful about this. But what I think, I think I mentioned it in the paper as well, what I think one could say is that when looking at, of course, one cannot reconstruct the functioning of the image merely by, you know, looking at it. One must look at the context of use, for sure. But once one does that, then one can see that, for example, that the schematism or the naturalism are symptoms of the use. So they have become functional for some reason. So, for example, this this mummy case is actually not of a pharaoh, but of a I don't know how to pronounce it. Phoenician king, forgot his name. I think I have it somewhere here. The Tabnit from Phoenicia, and this is from the 500 before Common Era. And at the same time, the same Phoenicians who produced this, because this is not produced by Egyptians, were able to produce the same, probably the same artists were able to produce such a sarcophagus that would be, let's say, Hellenistic or Greek in its outlook, but it would also be very schematic. My point is here that one could say, comparing the two cases, that one could say, well, this one is more schematic than the Greek one. But actually, when you look at the uses are the same. The idea is that these sarcophaguses are supposed to be idealized, godlike creatures that transport you to the yonder, to beyond. In a certain context, one could say, or when one would look away from the context, one could say, well, the Greek one is less schematic because it's part of a tradition where the scale of schematism is just different. Sorry for putting it in so unclear terms. So, yeah, there's... Yeah, that is to say, I totally agree with what you said. Yeah.
What comes to mind to me is David. I mean, already came to mind when we were discussing the black. I mean, the that kind of body or of the image of politics through mass. So I was thinking of David and the way he organized the processions in Paris, mm-hmm. and now he comes back with the difficulty that he had, the difficult choice between the martyr portrait or the Maha, and the martyr portrait, which was a more realistic kind of representation of death through that one boy who was killed by the state force, and then he went for the iconic image of Maha, modeled on Christ. So I can't quite know where, but I feel there is something in the way that that maybe David exploited those two regimes of substitution and commemoration, kind of struggling with it. at the moment, which is crucial in the sense of what the, what images can do. Mm. So. Mm.
Oof. Yeah, I'm struggling too.
And he abandoned the martyr one. He left it unfinished. So it was because it was not. He couldn't. I mean, the whole notion of realism and the creation of the sign and the, he left it there. And he went for something which went back to a prototype. So in a way, to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't think of anything smart to say.
I'm sure you can. Yeah, I'm sure you can. Over a cup of coffee later on. Would anyone like to raise another question? Rachel. Sorry.
Thank you. So that was really interesting. And I have a question. I appreciate the abstract level at which you presented your ideas, because that in many ways is the point of this gathering. But I'd like to ask a more concrete question about the mummy portraits, specifically in relation to substitution, and that is, what is that exactly is being substituted? What does the image replace? Is it the body? Is it the likeness? Is it life? Is it death? Is it presence? And I ask that because what's interesting about those portraits is that the thing that is the substitute, the portrait, remains adjacent to, even literally part of, the thing for which it is supposed to substitute. And that for me raises a question about both commemoration and substitution, and maybe a problem with both of them, and maybe this is where Heidegger comes into the mix. But in both cases, a presumption or assumption is made about the discreteness of entities, right? So there is a thing that then gets replaced by a thing, or there is a referent that is replaced by a sign, or an entity replaced by real metaphor. I mean, you know, I could generate many parallels. But if we think of mummy portraits in terms of their adjacency to the mummy and to, I don't actually know the term for Roman Egypt. Is it sarcophagus?
Suppose. I'm not an Egyptologist, so.
Okay, well, neither am I. So
let's go.
I'll just say coffin, because we all know what that is. I mean, Heidegger, for me, in proposing the idea of a thing as a gathering, seems interesting here, because what if it's substitution, but also a kind of gathering and a bringing together of multiple registers or layers of representation, iconicity, mimesis, substitution, so on and so forth.
So there's.
Maybe, start with the first question. What is being substituted?
Yeah. Well,
because I think
As far as I know, at the time of the, you know, we're talking about the first, let's say, first two centuries of Common Era, that is, when Egypt was the Roman colony, there was still what was still alive there was the idea that your decomposing body needs to be substituted for by the sarcophagus, by the mummy, and that is you. The reason why these mummies in the typical Egyptian imagery are, well, when we think of, let's say, the of this like typical iconic imagery of the pharaohs, they all look kind of the same, because they need to look kind of the same. Namely, they need to look like Osiris. I think it's Osiris, because the case becomes a vessel that transports you to the underworld in an idealized, almost godlike fashion. And the process of mummification, all that, is supposed to prepare the substitute. Now, what's startling about the Fayum portraits is that they precisely are, there is no work, at first glance, especially when they were discovered in the 1880s, many people thought they were fakes, because especially the shaded character that brought them to Europe, Graf, was a dealer in antiquities, and so there were some accusations of, you know, these being actually forgeries, because there was, first of all, there was this mind-boggling idea, how come these images that look like, you know, contemporary portraits, you know, painted by Bouguereau, or I don't know. So these are... there was actually, by the way, I didn't make that up. These were really like the reactions in London, like, oh my God, this is like Bouguereau. So this was one thing. The other thing was, from Egyptologist point of view, this didn't make sense, because there is no work of idealization. You're actually taking a flat, realistic, naturalistic image, and you just stick it to a mummy. Why would you do that? What's the rationale behind it? To this day, no one's really sure. There was this idea, actually, that's something that Belting and Summers both accept, that they actually really worked like portraits. They were actually put on display in the homes of the deceased as a sort of commemoration. So there was the function of commemoration, and then only afterwards they were stuck. But now today we know that that's probably not true, or in many cases not true. They were actually from the start actually part of the mummy. So that's why Riggs thinks that they were just, that there must be something more more creative work going on. Actually, taking the fashionable style and transforming it, making it part of, accommodating it for the Egyptian rituals. So it's hard to say what they're substituting. The idea that Belting and Summers are defending is that they are not, that's the whole point, is that they are not substituting, they are just like a photograph of, you know, your dead relative that you have in your wallet or whatever. But then, of course, we can talk about the interesting question whether you know, such, there is something in these images that prevents them from substitution, which I don't think is the case. Maybe a different, yeah. I haven't gone really into that, and I don't have it really thought out. But many interesting, one could, for example, think of Alfred Gell's Art and Agency, where, you know, he doesn't use the term substitution, but I think it basically is a theory of substitution, where he works with realistic images. So, yeah.
Thank you.
I'm not actually sure people had seen a Bouguereau before saying that. The Art of Riquet. This is the last question for this panel, I guess, because we are running slightly late. So.
Yeah, I'm now shocked because in your comment that they don't play different roles anymore, but were attached from the very beginning, that lets both theories you presented collapse, because for the theories it's absolutely essential that those images assume different roles and different stages and combine different kind of presences in the afterlife and in the present,
yeah.
And that the image plays not just one role but multiple roles in these moments of transitions. So if they were attached from the beginning, how does that kill their concepts?
Does it do
that at all? Because it does for me at the moment, but I'm sure you have a better answer.
I actually said towards the end of the paper that I think the graph is supposed to show that. Based on contemporary state of research into the practices surrounding the Fayum portraits, both Belting's and Summers' assertions about their functions are wrong. It's not that these images, these realistic portraits, were not related with the rituals of the with the death cult of the Egyptians. But I think that doesn't really, even if they were wrong, this is an empirical argument, so they might have been wrong, but there's a argument pertaining to the logic of substitution and commemoration that they developed that still holds, even if they were wrong, both wrong in interpreting. In reading the naturalism of the Fayum portraits as, and now we can discuss whether it's sure signs or symptoms of commemoration rather than substitution. There was probably something more creative going on when the Egypt, well, we don't even know whether these were Egyptians or rather the Greeks and Romans, you know, the clerks employed by the empire. Anyway, the people portrayed, whether the portraits of these people actually, they were actually made somehow part of the ritual. They were not actually just commemorative. But nevertheless, the idea that the central idea, I think, in both accounts is that these are functions that we can think of, like substitutive function and commemorative function, and as such, it should be thought of as symptomatic and not defining a certain group of images into two separate. Yeah, I'm getting mixed up, but. Make sense? Okay, good. Thank you for the great questions.
Thank you to Jacob.